Welcome to the film experience. This is your host, Nathaniel, and I'm here once again with Murtada Elfada.
Hi, Nathaniel, and good evening. We usually, record in the morning. This is the first time recording in the evening. It feels a little weird, but hopefully the conversation...
We both got our drinks in hand.
Yes, I have my vodka soda, enjoying it, very nice.
And my whiskey coke. I'm a whiskey man.
I think, having a drink is a good time to discuss Melissa McCarthy being a Julius in Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I was so delighted that Julius plays itself in that movie. And it was such a great choice to be a neighborhood bar in a movie, since it is a neighborhood bar.
Yes.
And it also has a really long history, so it was perfect for that movie.
Yeah, I think every queer person who's ever lived in New York or visited New York will recognize Julius. So that was just a delight every time they were in that bar.
And also, Julius is also in Pose, the Ryan Murphy series. Only in Pose, it's like an evil gay bar. So it's like it's very miscast in Pose.
Yeah, but in Can You Ever Forgive Me, it appears at itself. It plays itself. They even call it Julius, and you see the sign and everything.
That's right, because Julius has been around forever, and it's a great bar.
It is a great bar. And that's just one of the delightful things about the movie. The other thing that I recognize is it's such a New York movie, right? Like, The characters are very New York, the way they speak is very New York, where they go is very New York. So there's Julius, but also there's the house in work, which is the bookstore that's a couple of blocks from where I live. Mm-hmm. And that is actually miscast in the movie, or it plays another role, because that's the bookstore where she meets a very rude bookseller who kind of insults her. But it was funny to see that scene play at Housing Work, which is this, another very nice neighborhood bookstore that has a little cafe that I've spent many afternoons sitting in, reading and looking at my computer and having some coffee.
So, New York plays itself, sometimes miscast and sometimes perfectly cast in Can You Ever Forgive Me? And everybody plays themselves or characters really well in this movie. It's superbly acted.
Yes, somebody who's definitely not miscast is Melissa McCarthy, who is so wonderful in this part. I don't think she's ever been better. I've always loved her, but this is just such a delightful performance. Although it's not a delightful character, but she plays it so well that you can't help but love her, even though Lee Israel is a famous curmudgeon. Mm-hmm. And she does not sort of sand the edges of it. She, like, plays it with all of the... What would you call Lee Israel, Nathaniel? I don't want to say arrogant. There is a little bit of arrogance, but a little bit...
Curmudgeon is completely the right word. It's almost like the grumpy old man thing, only grumpy middle-aged lesbian. She's very, not, it's one of these people who comes across as having a superiority complex because they're so judgmental of other people. But at heart, it's not really about that. It's really just about their discomfort. In their own skin and in the choices they made in their life and all those other things. So she has just as much self-loathing as she does loathing for other people.
She does. And she certainly insults everyone. But she probably, like, if she were to meet her, she also insults herself because she talks about how she's not the writer that she wishes she were. Mm-hmm. And that she could only sort of come into this success, quote unquote success, by impersonating other better writers. Mm-hmm. It's a great character. It is a real person, but it's a great character that gives Melissa like a lot to play, and she does it all so well.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Richard E. Grant the other day for an interview that's forthcoming on the site, and he compared her personality to a porcupine, which I thought was very brilliant.
That is brilliant, yeah.
And
he
I'm
nailed
like,
it, yeah.
That's so correct.
Yeah. And she does all these things that are so, like, it's, you just feel the city and you feel this person, like, when she goes to that party and she steals a little bit of the food, but not just the food, she steals also, you know, sorry people for spoilers, but she takes
it's like the
toilet
like the first
paper.
The second scene.
It's yeah, like and I was, and I just, that is such a thing, because when you are living in a city as expensive as New York, you're trying to save all the time. Cut every place. So if she could just get, I don't know, a week's worth of toilet paper from this party, I think.
Are you trying to confess that you're a little shoplifter or something?
No, I'm not. But, you know, when you go to a, you know, I haven't done the toilet paper thing, but I have sort of like, you know, when you go to a party or when there's especially a corporate event, mm-hmm. you know, you'll have a couple more drinks than you usually would if you were paying for them.
Oh, 100%, yes.
And then the whole thing...
100% true.
The whole thing about the coat, which also happens so early, which is just so lovely that... Because you always, you never know with New York. Like, you might have a coat, but it might not be a great coat. I love the fact that she tried to also steal a coat. Because her coat was not very winter ready.
Right. Oh, there's so many great things about this movie. It's one of those movies that the more I think about it, the more I like it. So I'm very eager for a second round.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw it yesterday, and I'm ready for a second round. It just has so much heart, even though the person at the middle of it is, you know, is not, like, the easiest to fall in love with. But the way that she's played and just how funny she is and how her interactions with Richard E. Grant, who plays this other gay queer person who is her friend, who is also a little grifter, just like she is. Just their chemistry together and their friendship felt really real and earned. And even though, you know, they don't always support each other as best friends should, but mm-hmm. it all felt very real and interesting and very warm and lots of heart in this movie.
Great chemistry. What are you doing with your camera?
Oh, sorry.
The image of Murtada is moving like he's a director who's doing too many camera movements.
You know, and I'm only a third into my drink, so that is not a result of my drinks, listeners.
So what else do we have to say about Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I mean, one thing, you know, this is not in the movie, but one thing that I was looking at today is sort of the box office. I was a little disappointed that it didn't win the weekend in the sort of like the, what do we call, the small release.
Platform.
So the platform. It wasn't the highest average. No. That was for Jonah Hill's mid-90s. And I sort of went and looked at other Fox Searchlight movies and how they did, especially those that were nominated to Oscar, and, you know, it did a lot less than things like Jackie and Three Billboards, but it is more than Wild and slightly less than Brooklyn. So I think it's still going to do well, and those movies we know did well, like Wild and Brooklyn both did well. Those would be the comparisons to this box office.
Oh,
so
really?
I think,
like,
yeah.
Similar for their first weekend?
Yeah, it did slightly more than Wild and slightly less than Brooklyn, so in between those two.
Oh, okay. They both did well for themselves.
Yeah, they both did very well for themselves eventually.
And this is the kind of movie that people who love it will really be passionate about it and talk about it, which helps box office.
Yes, yes.
Theoretically.
For sure. Yes, you never know, but theoretically, yes. But I was also sort of disappointed that Melissa McCarthy didn't make the Gotham, but, you know, that's like, it's just four critics in a room choosing five people, so who knows what happened there.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Gotham's and their West Coast counterpart often have little strange exclusions that people shouldn't take as prophecies of what is to come, however
yes.
interesting they may be.
Yes. It's just an interesting note, like the box office, like, because I love the movie so much, and I think it has so much, you know, it has so much heart, and it, you know, acted so well and directed so well. Like, mm-hmm. this is such a great sort of like Mariel Heller is now 2 for 2 for me. I was just maybe hoping for box office, more awards, but you know, it's just open, so there is
and
a lot more.
We've only had one list for awards so far.
Exactly, yes.
It is October, we have to keep reminding ourselves.
Yeah, that's right, yes, right. So whenever it comes your way, you should definitely go see Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant in this movie.
Yes.
Do we want to say anything more about it? Is there a scene that you remember or a character detail that you love? I mean, she did have a...
There are so many things I love about it. This is how much I love the character. I even love the little tiny scenes where she's doing prank calls. And there's almost nothing I find more obnoxious than prank calls. Like, they were childish even when I was a child. I just don't understand the appeal, and yet I was laughing at those scenes.
It was very funny, and she does drop a lot of names. For people who are, like, into literary figures are really going to enjoy those scenes. Not just, you know, the letters that she forges, but to your point, the prank calls. Because the names she drops or impersonates there are also a delight. We don't want to spoil it, but I chuckled. It was very, very funny.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff. For people who, you know, like culture and literature and famous writers and stuff like that, there's a lot of great jokes and references. But even if you don't get them, like... one of the curious things about the movie is that Jack, the Richard E. Grant character, doesn't know who half the people are that she talks about, which is kind of interesting because, you know, gay men are supposed to be more sophisticated culturally, you know.
Yes, he plays a very unsophisticated gay man. Yes. So Richard E. Grant is really playing against type. He's not an erudite Brit, nor a sophisticated gay man.
But he's very funny in the movie. And they're both so moving. Like, in very subtle ways. Like, it really sneaks up on you how much power those character arcs accumulate.
And I've heard from so many people who saw the movie that they love this friendship. And a lot of people, especially queer people, see it as a real sort of queer friendship between two queer people. Wow, I said queer so many times.
You're just trying to get your point across. And both actors are straight, but what are you going to do?
Yes, but the movie is very, very queer. Though I think... it was written by Nicole Holofcener, who we love and has written a lot of amazing movies.
Yes.
And we already talked about Mariel Heller.
And Jeff Witte's co-writer, who wrote Avenue Q... also a very good writer. Go see that.
Is there anything that rubbed you? Do you have any criticism of the movie? I can't think of anything.
I thought there were a couple one scene things that were a little broad, like that rude salesperson. That whole thing that's used for comedy a couple times is, to me, the least successful part of the movie.
Yes. I agree with that. But one of the more successful parts, it's sort of the tentative romance. There is a romance, or sort of a romance, that anyway starts between Lee and someone in the movie. And I thought that was done very well. Also, somebody who is a curmudgeon like Lee will, of course, raised so many obstacles in the face of any interest from any person who wants to break the walls around her. So I thought that was handled really beautifully and acted well by Melissa McCarthy and Dolly Wells as the woman who's trying to court her.
Yes. And you don't often see that sort of thing in movies, because when movies attempt any love interest in movies is almost never handled in this way where... it's a character detail rather than a plot. It's a character detail that she does not let people in that way.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Even though she's a lesbian and this woman is interested in her, who she actually likes in her limited way.
Yes,
and yet she still can't, you know, open up to that.
Yeah, that whole, those scenes were just so beautiful. And I loved Melissa and Dolly playing that. They did it so well. Mm-hmm. Just, and because, we talked about how this is, all the characters are queer, but none of the people who wrote it or directed it or acted it are queer. But I thought it handled sort of queer middle-aged romance really well in that subplot. It's not really a subplot because, as you said, it's a character detail, but it's just beautifully handled.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff Whitty is queer, so at least there's a queer voice somewhere in the mix. yes. So.
And that sort of also builds to the whole sort of like New York thing. Like there are, as you walk around, it is a big, beautiful city, but also people can be so lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found those two characters and their attempts to connect just so moving. And something that, I think a lot of us live in the city.
Mm-hmm. So you saw two movies this week that I have not seen yet because I was just off at a festival. So do you want to say a few words about Mid-90s, which I'll just admit I have no interest in seeing unless you tell me I have to see it.
John, who writes the Month Merrill in the site, I think he had the best tweet about this movie. Also, he didn't want to see it. I think, I'm sorry, John, I'm misquoting you, but it was something like, will being gay sort of give him a pass out of seeing the movie? And I really, and just to expand on that, I wish I was turned down at the door. No, you're gay. This movie's not for you. You can't go in.
And Jonah Hill's directorial debut, correct?
Yeah, so Jonah Hill can shoot a movie, but I just had no interest in its subject matter. I had no interest in their characters. I didn't like the way it used all the, the N-word and the F-word, and I don't mean fuck, just so all the time. And it is about teenagers in the 90s, and they were used, they must be using those words, but I'm just like, okay, the 17 millionth time I heard them, I'm like, what's next? Like, can we move this along? What is this plot about?
Yeah.
But, I saw it at the screening, and the guy next to me was enjoying every minute. He was enjoying it so much and laughing at every joke and every scene that he annoyed me, and I hated the movie even more because of that. But I guess it is for some people out there.
The podcast in which Murtada plays Melissa McCarthy and Can You Ever Forgive Me and hates everyone.
Yes.
And everything.
Only mid-90s and anybody who liked it.
Okay, so I'm not going to see this. Because it's not an Oscar prospect. And
it does have Lucas Hedges, so I don't know. He has some fans.
I love him, actually. I didn't know he was in it. Or I'd forgotten
he was. It has Lucas Hedges and Kathleen, what is her name? Waterston, as in small supporting parts. They play the brother and the mother of the lead character, who I think is around 11.
Hmm. Okay, so we'll move on from that one. The other one I'm actually much more curious about because I was supposed to go to this movie, but I missed the screening. The Guilty, which is Denmark's Oscar submission.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I recommend that movie. I enjoyed it very much. It's anybody who have who it's really short. I think it's only 85 minutes, but that's not its only virtue. It's a very tight thriller. It takes place in one location with one character, everybody else is on the phone. It's kind of a lock situation, that Tom Hardy movie. But it is just more intense than that, and the stakes are much higher. It's about, he plays, the lead character is a police officer who's at a call center who gets a call from a woman who's kidnapped, and then it's for the next hour and a half he's trying to save her while staying on the phone with her. It's just, and it's not that claustrophobic, even though it's in that one place. It's really, really, you know, the director builds the tension well. I would recommend this movie. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if it made the 9. I think this is a very strong year for the foreign language Oscar. There are so many other amazing movies, so we'll see what happens with it. But it's definitely a worthy inclusion in the list.
And people don't really know this because people don't really study foreign film statistics as we do at the Film Experience, but Denmark is actually currently, not all-time leader, but currently Oscar's favorite country for that category.
Of all time?
No, currently.
Oh, so currently.
Like in the past dozen years, Denmark has been nominated 6 times and nothing else has come close to that. So basically 50% of the time in the past dozen years they've been nominated.
That's a very good chance for the guilty then. 1 out of 2.
Yeah, so yeah, Denmark is very popular right now. And the reason I say that is because Oscar tends to go in waves with countries. I don't know why. I can't really think why. But it, you can see it all through their history. They get focused on one country. Sometimes it's due to a certain director, but other times it's just random, you know. Yeah, so I want to see that.
Yeah, I think it opened, I'm trying to find out, but I think it opened in more than just New York and LA this week.
It has like 29 theaters or something, so it must be in other cities too.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that's pretty good for a foreign language movie to start at 29 theaters.
Yeah.
So skip Jonah Hill, go see the Danish Oscar entry. That's my verdict. And there is another movie that opened this week that I haven't seen, but I think you saw. What can you tell us about What They Had?
This is a rare event for me. I can tell you, go see a Hilary Swank movie.
Wow, Nathaniel.
I know. I'm growing up. I'm evolving. It's a family ensemble drama. Hilary Swank is the lead, but it's basically an ensemble, although she's definitely the lead. And it's about, I almost said young woman, but she has a teenage child in the movie. It's about a middle-aged siblings whose parents are, the mother is having dementia, and they're trying to decide what to do about the father, who won't put the mother in a nursing home. And she, at the very, very beginning of the movie, like the first scene, she wanders out of her house into a snowstorm and they're all frantically looking for her, which sets off all the action.
Michael Shannon is the brother.
Yeah. So Michael Shannon and Hilary Swank are the brother and sister, and they're really good together. Like there's a really great sibling chemistry, a strange sibling chemistry, because they don't speak a lot. That kind of chemistry where you can feel history, but it doesn't feel close.
Yeah.
So I think it was really well judged, their performances. And it's a more complicated character than Hilary Swank usually plays. And I liked her in it. I know.
Wow.
New things.
She's doing well, because the last time was The Homesman her last role? I liked her in that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is her first role after a long break, which she also spent caring for her ailing parent. So then she went into, to come back from the break, she made a movie about a woman whose parents are ailing.
Wow.
But the big takeaway from the movie is Robert Forster, who of course was Oscar nominated for Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown back in the day, is terrific as the dad. Just terrific.
And he hasn't actually been, his profile hasn't been high since that Oscar nomination.
I think he probably was on some ballots for The Descendants.
Oh, I forgot he was in that. Oh, yes,
but,
yes.
So that was his most recent thing where it seemed like something might happen. Mm-hmm. This is the best I've personally seen him since Jackie Brown. I loved him. In that.
Oh, wow. So do you think he's going to be in contention?
Well, the movie had almost no takers this weekend. So first weekends for limited release are always tricky, especially in October. But it reminds me a little bit of, do you remember what happened to Cate Blanchett? Starred in that movie Truth, was it called?
Yes, oh my god, yeah, that movie vanished immediately.
It vanished immediately, like nobody went to it. She was really good in it, but like people just had no interest in the movie.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, they haven't promoted it a lot, I guess. But it seems like the type of movie that people will actually really like if they see, but it doesn't seem, maybe they won't go see it, you know. Like if they saw it on HBO, they would probably love it.
Oh, okay.
But it is a very modest, like, it's just, you know, a family drama. And there's not a lot of movies like that anymore. They always have to be higher stakes than that, you know.
Mm. And they're not really doing a big campaign, because I was thinking, if this is such an actor's showcase, is this a movie that might surprise with, like, one of those strange SAG nominations?
I mean, it wouldn't be out of character for SAG. If enough of the nominating committee loves it. I mean, it's definitely an actor's movie. It's like basically, you know, five characters. Thaisa Farmiga's the daughter.
Whose daughter?
Hillary's daughter.
Okay.
So it's basically those five characters and a couple other random people show up from time to time, but it's basically the five of them.
Oh, okay. Well,
so I recommend it. If you like family dramas and any of those actors, it's totally a good fit. It's also a female writer-director to support women making movies. Especially when the movies are good.
Yeah. So that's two female directors this weekend in small release, because Marielle Heller with Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah. And this doesn't have, like, the sort of stylistic confidence of, like, Marielle Heller right out of the gate, like with Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is such a director's movie, you know?
Yes.
This is more of a writer's/actor's movie.
Yes.
It's kind of no frills, but the acting's really good, and it's moving, and I liked every character, even though they are problematic, shall we say.
You know, just to go back to Can You Ever Forgive Me for a second, you know how I just, watching Melissa McCarthy, you know the story that Julianne Moore was supposed to be, was supposed to play Lee Israel?
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't imagine that, because I, you know, now after I've seen Melissa, I can't imagine that. But there is a story making the rounds that apparently she had creative differences, and that's why she dropped out of the movie. But I, you know, not that I don't want to see Julianne Moore, but I am happy that it was Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, they would have had to do major makeup work on Julianne Moore to pull that off. It would have been definitely a de-glam, like, situation there.
Yeah. And I think Melissa McCarthy is a little younger than Lee Israel when that happened, but it still worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that's definitely, it should be way, way up there on your list of movies to see.
Absolutely.
And I think we have a major disagreement on our last movie.
We do, yes.
Okay, so last week, Murtada had not seen Beautiful Boy. And he was like, which movie should I see for us to discuss? And I'm like, you probably need to see Beautiful Boy because I hate it so much and it will be fun to talk about. But then you went and it sounds like you loved it.
I did. I think I was in a really vulnerable place when I went. I was like, and I just worked for me. I felt so many things watching that movie. I loved the performances. I thought it was just, I loved it. I don't know. But I am really curious to hear from you because I went, you know, because I trust what you think. And I went into that movie a little bit like, oh, I'm not going to like this movie. And then I liked it.
Well, the thing is, I went into it expecting to like it. So maybe this is a case of expectations coloring reactions. Because I really liked Broken Circle Breakdown, which was the director's, you know, international breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't like that movie, but I really loved it.
Let me set up. So the Beautiful Boy, for those of you who don't know, it's based on two memoirs, right? One, I think, is called Beautiful Boy, which is the memoir of the dad. And the other memoir is called Tweak. So it's about a father-son relationship. The father is Steve Carell. The son is Timothée Chalamet. The son is addicted to crystal meth. He is a teenager. He started taking it when he was a young teenager, maybe 15, 16, something like that. The movie sort of takes place over, I'm not sure exactly, but maybe 4 or 5 years as he goes through cycles of addiction and how his family, not just his dad, but his mother, his stepmom, Maura Tierney, and his mom, Amy Ryan, all of them, how they deal with his addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a fair sort of summary of the film?
That is a fair summary of the film, and it's also a reminder that Timothée Chalamet is not a supporting actor in the movie, contrary to his Oscar campaign.
Well, the first half is mostly from Steve Carell's point of view.
And then the second half dead. Is mostly from Timothée Chalamet's point of view.
Yeah.
And it's a father's, it's basically a romantic drama only without the romance between two people. So it's two leads.
Yeah. I just found the two performances really moving. And I was surprised to read a lot of reviews that Steve Carell's performance didn't work for people. And I'm not sure is that because he, you know, people know him and love him from The Office and have seen him so many hours of his acting that it just became familiar to them. I've never seen The Office, so I don't have that reference, and I was thinking if that's why people did not respond to him. What is your take on that?
Well, I have really liked him as an actor in the past. Like, I loved him in Little Miss Sunshine back in the day. That's when I first was like, wow, I really like him as an actor. But lately, I've really turned. I thought he was doing way too much in Foxcatcher. And in this one, I feel like he was doing way too little, and I felt like I had seen it from him before. It felt like, I mean, most people didn't see this movie, but I think last year he was in a movie, Last Flag Flying?
Yeah, I remember. I haven't seen that one.
Where in that movie he was a dad in mourning also. And so it just felt very similar, only not fully imagined. Like, you know, nobody likes Last Flag Flying as a movie. That's fine. I didn't really like it either, but he was really good in it. And I just found him really flat in this. And then the opposite with Timothée Chalamet, where I felt like Timothée Chalamet was doing too much. So I just did not respond well to the actor. It's the only actor who I was just like, yes, was Maura Tierney.
Yeah, she's good, but
she doesn't have much to do in the movie.
Yeah, but Timothy is playing an addict.
No,
he
has to do too
much.
I am being too harsh now because I wanted to get across why I didn't like it. Because there are scenes and individual line readings. There are moments that I think he's amazing in the movie, but as a whole. As like a whole performance, I guess I'm reacting to people wanting him to get an Oscar for it. I just don't think it's stellar work. He's good in it. He's definitely the best part of the movie as a whole, because there's a lot to grab onto with that performance, but it seems a little overworked, maybe. And then Steve Carell feels underworked, which basically points to me as like a directorial problem.
The director didn't choose the right takes.
Or some, yeah, or, and I also thought structurally it didn't work. Like, the, I hated, like, absolutely loathed the framing device, which seemed to be trying to keep you guessing as to what Steve Carell was doing in this office talking about his son. Like, it almost plays the initial, like, prologue, like, it's a mystery we have to solve, but it's really nothing. It really matters in no way to the movie why he's talking to a person about his son. It's like, so it feels like really misjudged from the beginning.
It does come back because he's talking to Timothy Hutton, right? And he's playing sort of a doctor, and it comes back when he's basically doing research on what it means to be an addict and the effects of addiction and how... and what it would do to his son's brain. So it does come back.
Right, but why is it played out? Like, why do they pitch it as, like, who is he talking to? What is this about? It's very cagey, and it just didn't make any sense to make that a mystery. Because it doesn't lead anywhere. When you finally realize what the conversation was about, you're like, oh, okay. Of course. Yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's just a nothing reveal, so why act like it's going to be a reveal? So it's like one problem after another I had with the movie, and I just really, really didn't like it. But I'm happy you enjoyed it.
I did. I mean, I realized that, you know, aesthetically the movie is very middle of the road. Like, it's not exciting at all. Like, when you compare it with the movie that also I saw this week, which is Can You Ever Forgive Me, and what Mariel Heller is doing there aesthetically, this movie is very, like, just there aesthetically. But I think the performances and just the story itself really moved me. And if we were to judge a movie by how much it makes us feel, this movie made me feel a lot, especially I felt like sort of like there is a moment later in the movie, I don't want to give it up, but basically where Steve Carell sort of reaches an impasse in his relationship with his son, and he changes the way that he's dealing with it, and I thought that was very, very moving. And there is a character that appears very late in the movie and gives a monologue. And that literally wrecked me, and I was sobbing in the movie, in the theater.
Who was this?
I think it's played by Lisa Gay Hamilton. And she comes in late in the movie. It's a one scene monologue, but basically the monologue is the essence of the movie. She plays, another parent who also has a child dealing with addiction, and she talks
about... Right. Okay, yeah.
And she talks about her experience, and it's sort of too neat a bow to put on the story that we've just watched, but also it just worked emotionally, and I felt, it's not her performance per se, because the movie, the scene is not played on her face, it cuts from her and way back, it plays on everybody else's faces, so everybody is giving it, like, Maura Tierney gets a little bit, Timothy is there, Steve Carell, we all cut from Lisa Gay to all these other actors, but I think it's just the message that she was saying that really affected me about how, you know, you can't really sometimes be able to help who you love, no matter your intentions.
Yes. I wish that it had done something for me, but it did nothing for me. But, and I think if you want to see a movie about addiction and how confusing that is for the loved ones of addicts, I think A Star Is Born, weirdly enough, is much more successful at that.
I liked it a lot. So
we want to hear from you people listening, if you saw Beautiful Boy, or check it out and let us know where you fall on it, because clearly it is not getting a... Because even its reviews are this way. They're kind of all over the place.
Yeah, the reviews are very middling about it. And although the box office was okay for that first weekend, like, it did well in the two or three theaters it was released on last weekend. But I'm not so sure how it did the second weekend. I don't think I checked.
It did really well this weekend, too. Wait, oh wait, no wait, I'm on the wrong chart. Sorry. This is so, like, nerdy. Let's look at box office charts. Okay, it didn't do as well this week in terms of per screen average, but it did pretty good. I think it's gonna do okay.
So maybe it's Oscar hopes are not dead, because I think a lot of, like, people were writing it off because of the reviews, but maybe now the okay box office will resurrect. I don't know yet that I would put either of those performances in the top five of the year in their categories, but I was very moved by them, so I wouldn't be, you know, unhappy if either of them were to be nominated for any award.
Guess what I saw this weekend?
Tell me.
Green Book.
Oh, wow. Look at you, Nathaniel. You're seeing the Oscar juggernaut of the year.
And if it plays to the Academy crowds how it paid to the Middleburg crowd, the Middleburg Film Festival, which I tend to think of as an Oscar crowd, it tends to be older people, affluent people. They just ate this movie up. Oh my God. They were laughing uproariously at every single joke. Standing ovation for the director.
Wow.
They just ate it up. I went, by the end of the screening, I was like, yeah, Peter Farrelly is getting nominated for Best Director too, even though before I thought that wouldn't happen.
Oh, you think he's going to get nominated?
I think the movie could even win Best Picture.
Oh, wow. But do you think...
It's just so, like, I thought it's really broad. It's kind of, you know, people are comparing it to Driving Miss Daisy, but I think that's not really accurate. It's much more like Hidden Figures, I would say.
Mm.
Because it's very sort of... It's not really, like, deep, but it's really enjoyable.
Mm.
And it's about these, like, race relations and the way that Hidden Figures was, where it's, like, very inspiring, but it's not too challenging, you know? And Viggo Mortensen's really fun in the lead role. And Mahershala is also lead, but, you know, he's campaigning supporting.
Yeah, because my reaction to the, you know, I just saw the trailer, and I remember when the trailer was first released, I don't know, a couple of months ago, I was like, are we really doing this in 2018? There's even a joke about fried chicken. Come on. I mean, I rolled my eyes so hard at that trailer, so I don't know. But, you know, the reaction from everybody who's seen it has been very positive.
I mean, they were just eating it up, I'm telling you. I mean, it's not going to be on my top 10 or anything, but it's a crowd pleaser. Like, if there's a single adjective to describe it, that's it.
But did it please you?
It was okay. Like, it was enjoyable. It was an enjoyable watch. It had some problematic moments, of course. fried chicken. There's a whole big scene about that.
But is this a movie that when it goes into wider release, wider audiences, different critics, not just, you know, the people who go to Middleburg and Toronto, will the critical word change about it?
It doesn't seem to me the type of movie that could be hurt by criticism, because it's really fun and well-meaning as a movie. So those type of movies, when critics attack them, it feels mean, if that makes sense. Because the movie obviously has good intentions, and it is really kind of adorable to a certain degree. So anyway, I was very surprised by watching it and feeling the energy in the room, just being completely besotted with it. So those experiences are always strange. That's one of the reasons I love actually going to movies as opposed to critic screenings or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, because festival screenings, like, people act like it's all this elitist thing, but it's not... I mean, you have to make it more of an effort than you would just to go to your local movie theater. But it's still general audiences. It just happens to be
audiences
that would go to a film festival.
But it's also audiences who know they're in for a special treat. I mean, that's how I feel at film festivals.
Yeah.
It's a special treat. I'm seeing movies before everybody else. So there's,
yeah.
there's already sort of like, I am 30% in to like the movie.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. yeah. So it feels more eventful in that circumstance. But I do think it's going to be, I do think it's going to be a huge hit in the way Hidden Figures was. Cause it's,
yeah.
cause it's really funny, even though it's kind of broad. Like I was
yeah.
surprised it would be absolutely, I would be surprised if it isn't comedy for Golden Globes.
Yeah, because there are not that many comedies now
yeah.
this year. I don't know. Unless The Favorite's going to be a comedy, then
yeah,
then it will
sure
have
that one is too. And whereas The Favorite is more of a tragic comedy, this is more
yeah.
of like a straight up comedy with dramatic elements.
Yes. Interesting.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot more to discuss about it. So when it comes out and people can, I'm eager to discuss it with all of you, with all the readers and with you in greater detail.
Well, at least, you know, we can agree that Can You Ever Forgive Me and Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant are amazing and superb.
Yes, we can agree on that.
So if we were Ebert and Roper, that would be the 1-2 thumbs up you agreed on today.
I can't believe you invoked the name Richard Roper on this podcast.
Well, you know, it's late. I finished my drink.
Attacked right now. I feel attacked.
Oh. See,
because I'm sure you're thinking of yourself as Ebert.
No, no, not necessarily. You can be Ebert. This is what you get for asking to record at night.
That's true. And I'm like so tired right now, but I have to finish watching a movie. I'm halfway through.
So I think we can end it here on a positive, sort of a positive note. Kind of, maybe not.
What's the positive note?
That we both liked Melissa McCarthy.
Yes. I mean, she's just great in that movie. But Best Actress, oh my god, it's so competitive this year. I have like 8 women that I want to nominate in my own personal awards, and there's only 5 slots. I'm very upset about
this. So let's give the people what they want and love and discuss Best Actress briefly.
Okay.
So you have Melissa now as your 4th likely to be nominated.
Yeah.
Ahead of her, Olivia Colman, Lady Gaga, and Glenn Close. So do you think this box office and the fact that she missed that one award changes your mind, or is she still definitely, is she still, like, in the top 4?
I think she's still in the top 4. I hate to say, I mean, it is only October, and so I hate to act like 4 people are locked up, but I do think it's going to be hard to dislodge Glenn, Lady Gaga, Olivia Colman, or Melissa McCarthy. So I think it's basically a bloodbath for spot number 5. That's my current read on the situation.
So you think that there is the other 6 women in your top 10, one of them could be the 5th, or is it?
Yeah.
Is it 4?
No, I feel like it's any of them.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And
I can see that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Glenn seems to be, like, just, she got the Gotham nomination. You know, 20 Pictures Classic bought her that same award they bought for Julianne Moore, Hollywood Film Awards or whatever. So she'll get some, she'll get some press.
She got some expensive hardware there.
She'll get to give a seat for Shishin. She's on her way. And, of course, Star is Born is huge, so Gaga's definitely on her way, too.
I mean, I can't remember if we said this last week. Did we say this last week? Did we talk Glenn Close last week?
Yeah, I don't think so. We didn't bring her up at all.
Well, I had just seen Mother of the Maid last week.
Oh, yeah, but you didn't even tell us what you thought of it.
Oh, she's great in it. And so she's really on fire this year, because she's great in that play. And I think it's really wise for her to be doing a play right now, because it takes the pressure off for right now, but that play's run ends in December, early December.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of time for her to jump right into Golden Globes and all that stuff.
Yeah, but also, if her performance in the play is so well, that means all the people in New York who vote for awards can go see her and have another reason to vote her as Actress of the Year.
Right. Essentially, yes. I mean, people downplay, you know, stage stuff all the time. I mean, people... I remember this specifically. I think it's worth talking about on the podcast when Mark Rylance was, you know, rumored to be a contender early in the year before it happened, and then he actually won. Mm-hmm. I kept mentioning that actors worship him, and
yes.
I got a lot of pushback. Like, nobody knows who he is, and I'm like, no. People know who he is. Actors know who he is.
Yeah.
Like, people don't
yeah.
realize that actors are very aware of stage legends.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't like the general public in that they never go to theater or anything like that. Actors are just like a, it's like its own world. And there are certain actors that other actors just worship.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, yeah.
So if
and
you
definitely...
have like a huge hit on stage, it can really help with other campaigns.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've heard the same thing also about Olivia Colman, but, like, the industry knows who Olivia Colman is, even though she has not been the lead in the movie before
right.
this year. But, like, everybody who works in the industry, TV, movies,
mm-hmm.
in the UK, she did stage, everybody knows who she is and have seen her and love her, so
yeah.
the same thing.
Yep. So I think this play was a very smart move on Glenn Close's part. Also, because
yeah.
it's a much different role than she usually plays. And Olivia Colman, of course, all her past work that people love will help with the favorite, too.
Yeah. And Mahershala will have True Detective. If it's good, that will help him, too. So they all have, like, a second card.
Exactly. Yeah, Oscar nominations are never only about that performance. Are the rarely only about one performance.
Yeah.
Let's say that.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next
Thank
week.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Murtada. Right.
Thank you, Nathaniel.
Thanks for listening, and especially those who comment. We want to continue the discussion with you, so please do comment.
Yes, please. We love your comments.